nombre es Gerardo Dutkowski. Estoy colaborando con el Congreso de Investigación desde el inicio en la parte de contenidos. Y me da mucho gusto hoy poder presentar con ustedes alguien que en los últimos años ha sido un referente en la discusión acerca de la crisis en el mundo, que arrancó, digamos, podemos pensar más o menos alrededor de 2008, aunque hay diferencias en la fecha exacta, pero de la cual todavía estamos viviendo, ¿no? Y parece que vamos a estar un tiempito más. Vamos a tener ahorita la conferencia magistral de Yannis Varoufakis. Yannis nació en Atenas, en Grecia, y estudió, digamos, en Essex, economía matemática. Luego hizo una maestría en estadística matemática en Birmingham, y su PhD en economía también es en Essex, donde fue profesor, además de profesor en muchas universidades. Estuvo en Sydney, en Cambridge, en East Anglia, en Glasgow, en la Universidad Católica de Lovaina, en la Universidad de Atenas, donde además fue fundador del programa doctoral en economía. Y es actualmente también profesor visitante en la Lyndon B. Johnson, en la Graduate School of Public Affairs, en la Universidad de Texas en Austin. Es autor de muchos libros, y pues a partir de la crisis en 2008 fue activo, como dijimos, en varios de los debates que tienen que ver con la crisis. Sacaron la modesta propuesta para resolver la crisis del euro junto con Stuart Holanda y James Galbraith. Y un libro de los más conocidos de él fue el que sacó sobre el Minotauro Global, Global Minotaur, que acaba de sacar su segunda edición ahorita, y además es un activo participante, dijimos, en las discusiones. Actualmente se convirtió en asesor del secretario general en París para la OCDE, la Organización de Cooperación y Desarrollo Económico, en cuestiones relacionadas con la crisis económica mundial y europea. Nos da mucho gusto que hoy esté con nosotros Yannis. Nos va a hablar sobre Banking Challenge in the Post-2020 World, también el tema bancario, digamos, en los momentos actuales. Bienvenido, es un honor para nosotros tenerte aquí, Yannis, y adelante. Y al final, como siempre, vamos a hacer una sesión de preguntas y respuestas. Muchas gracias.
Thank you ever so much for this introduction. You cannot stir a flower without troubling of a star, or so famously remarked Francis Thompson. The implied interconnectedness in this poetic line is even more pertinent in our financialized global economy than in the most non-linear of the vestiges of Mother Nature. At least this is my excuse for accepting the kind invitation to be here today to address an audience on the subject of banking, and in particular in the context of the debates unfolding here in Mexico regarding financial sector reform. For if the cutting of a flower troubles a star, then surely the collapse of the Cypriot banking system, the trials and tribulations of Spanish banks, and the way that they are being supposedly recapitalized by the European Stability Mechanism are surely pertinent to what is happening in Mexico's financial sector today. Before I continue, let me express my gratitude to the organizers, and in particular to Adalberto Palma, and of course to this illustrious seat of learning, ITAM, for the great honor and the considerable privilege you're affording me by having me here today. You may have noticed that I'm afflicted by a certain condition. I am Greek. The kinder souls amongst you, I can see, are waving sympathetically your head. The less sympathetic are wondering what on earth is a Greek economist doing lecturing you on financial sector and reform and the global crisis. Allow me to quip that Greece is in everyone's rear view mirrors these days. And as car mirrors often warn, you've seen the sticker under the car mirrors usually, objects in mirrors are closer than they appear. Indeed, I submit to you that Mexico and Greece have too much in common. And I'm not referring just to the beginnings of our nations in the 1810s and 1820s through revolutionary wars. No, I'm afraid I'm referring to less heroic deeds like defaults, massive capital flights into and out of our countries, incorporation into a trade bloc comprising bigger and more powerful northern neighbors, and of course a great deal of political and social unrest as a result of all of the above. In 2009, the crash of 2008 gave rise to the implosion of Greece. Greece effectively became insolvent, even though we never admitted to it, falling into the lap of the IMF and that of our European partners. While at the same time, Mexico was having its own encounter of the third type with the IMF and one of the largest credit lines ever extended to a country, if not the largest, by the International Monetary Fund. Allow me to suggest that if Mexico lacked a central bank at that time, if you could not devalue, as you did, your currency by 25% or so, if while all this was happening, you were not allowed to default, while at the same time you were failing to refinance your debt, if Europe had not sucked into its banking sector for 10, 15 years before the calamity of 2008, mountains of toxic derivatives that in the end you were spared in this country, then I suggest to you that Mexico would today not be very unlike the wreckage that is Greece. My Mexican friends and colleagues tell me that Mexico is today finding it hard to escape the doldrums of the crisis that began in 2008. That growth has suddenly turned negative, and credit is relatively scarce. Looking at the data, they seem to be correct. However, the benefit of having a Greek address you is that I can legitimately look at you in the eye and say, friends, you have plunged to depths to which we aspire to. We aspire to rising to the depths that you have plunged into. But enough on Greece and Europe, at least for now. Time to look at the broader picture and the challenges of banking reforms in the post-2008 period, globally and then closer to home, to Mexico. In what follows, I propose to do the following. First, I want to ask a question that Laurence Olivier, that I don't know whether you remember that 1970s amazing movie, The Marathon Man, while torturing Dustin Hoffman with a dental drill, kept asking him, is it safe? Well, that is the question I'll ask about the financial sector, globally. Then I want to speak briefly on the blame the bankers game and argue for a more sophisticated approach to the question of banking ethics, banking practices, and what they mean for the global and the local economy. Third, I shall put forward my own theory of what happened in 2008 and what this means for the changed reality that we're experiencing after that. With this global perspective in place, I shall turn the spotlight on what is officially, I think these days, referred to as SIFIs, S-I-F-I, systemically important financial institutions. You can even think of it as systemically idiotic financial institutions, but that's another thing. The idea is not, however, to judge them, but to comprehend their functioning. Lastly, I shall ask the inevitable question, what should we do? How should we reform our financial sector in view of the world that we live in as shaped after 2008? So let's begin with the Laurence Olivier question. Is it safe? Is finance safe after the round of supposed reforms following the 2008 crash? Post-2008, there is an understanding urge of most people to believe two things at once. To believe first that the banks brought the financial catastrophe upon our heads, and secondly, to believe that after that, we've learned our lesson and finance is safer. Both beliefs are profoundly wrong. banks did not cause the mess, even though they played a gigantic role in bringing it about. And no, finance has not been fixed. Now, castigating banks after the crash of 2008 for the scandalous greed of the bankers, their propensity to fail not just taxpayers and customers, but also shareholders, their gross incompetence, all that castigation can be fun. And it is not at all undeserved. But alas, it throws little light on the deeper causes of what happened. Moralizing is not a sound foundation for economic policy. I try to tell my German friends this, but they don't listen. One does not need to be a bona fide member of the Occupy Wall Street movement to agree that our banking systems, generally, are a clear and present danger to our social economies. Last June, actually on the 19th of June, Mervyn King, the outgoing governor of the Bank of England, gave his last speech as governor. And I quote, "The sheer size and complexity of global banks," he said, "have led to failures of governance. Governments, regulators, prosecutors, and non-executive directors have all struggled to come to terms with firms that pose a risk to taxpayers, cannot be prosecuted because of their systemic importance, and are difficult to manage because of their size and complexity. It is not in our interest to have banks that are too big to fail, too big to jail, or simply too big." Now, given the highly oligopolistic structure of Mexico's banking sector, we just saw this in the previous presentation, I believe that you need to take serious note of Mr. Mervyn King's parting shot. In particular, his conclusion that, and I quote, "solving these problems is a work of a generation or two." Now, Andy Haldane, the remarkable executive director of financial stability, this is an almost Orwellian title, the director of the stability of the Bank of England, several years ago, in response to the catastrophe of 2008, and I'm sure that most of you remember that, dared say, "there is a key difference between the situation today and that in the Middle Ages. Then, the biggest risk to the banks was from the sovereign, from the state. Today, perhaps the biggest risk to the state, to the sovereign, comes from the banks. Causality has been reversed." So no, it is not safe to think that global finance has been tamed, and banks have turned the corner. As Mervyn King put it, it will take at least a generation to get that. However, we shall fail if we lull ourselves into a blame the banks game without understanding the deeper causes of the banks' collective and individual failures. Why were banks allowed to grow so complex and to increase their rent-sinking power so magnificently since the collapse of the Bretton Woods system on 15th of August 1971? The observation that they grew in power and significance does not contain its own explanation. Greed was never a cause of anything. It was a byproduct. It's not that bankers were not greedy in 1963, for instance. Similarly, with the bankers' exorbitant privilege, the capacity effectively to print private money in the 1980s and 80s. That was a byproduct too. But a byproduct of what? A byproduct of the rise and rise of what I called in the book that was kindly mentioned before, the global minotaur. You see, as a Greek, I cannot escape mythology. But as an economist, I try to turn it into science, supposedly. Now, since the 1970s, the United States of America, cutting to the chase now, since the 70s, the United States of America began absorbing a large portion of the rest of the world's surplus capital and of the rest of the world's surplus industrial products. In turn, the profits earned by the surplus nations' entrepreneurs were returned daily to Wall Street in the form of capital inflows. Capital that was flowing into the United States in search of higher payoff, higher returns. Wall Street would then use the influx of foreign capital for three purposes. Firstly, to provide credit to American consumers. Secondly, as direct investment to United States corporations. And thirdly, to buy US Treasury bills and thus finance one of the two deficits. Central to this global surplus recycling mechanism were Americans' twin deficits. They are the minotaur that I'm referring to. Without them, without these deficits, the global circular flow of goods and capital could not have closed. And the global economy would have been destabilized by a dearth of aggregate demand. This recycling system broke down because Wall Street took advantage of this central position, of its exorbitant privilege to build colossal pyramids of private money on the back of the net profits that were flowing from the rest of the world into Wall Street. The process of private money minting by Wall Street banks, also known as financialization, added much energy to the recycling scheme as it oozed oodles of new financial vitality, thus fueling an ever-accelerating level of demand within the United States, in Europe, whose banks soon jumped onto the bandwagon of private money-making, and of course Asia. Alas, the central position of Wall Street and its capacity to exploit the capital flows between $3 and $5 billion every day, in net terms, brought about the demise. Now, Mexico suffered the collapse that the Eurozone now experiences much earlier in 1994-95, at a time when the global recycling mechanism I just described was just beginning to gather pace. The foreign and local banks and the Mexican economy, largely due to the same developments that brought about NAFTA, experienced the rapid capital flows and outflows that brought about your grand banking crisis in 1994, closely intertwined by a major economic recession downturn. So Mexico in 94-95 was a prelude to what is happening in Europe's periphery today. After our own capital inflows put our banks in jeopardy. In a sense, 1994, however tragic it might have been for Mexico, shielded you from a catastrophe in 2009, which would have been much, much worse had you not experienced that which you felt in your bones in 1994. Now, going back to the circular flow of surpluses that characterized the period between Paul Volcker's rule in the Fed in the late 1970s and in 2008, the period when American deficits were at the heart of the Great Moderation, as it was once called, which was nothing but other than immoderate, of course, that was the environment in which banks grew into SIFIs, into systemically important financial institutions, into the banks that, according to Andy Haldane, continue to pose a clear and present danger to civilization as we know it. Now, the major problem with these banks that grew out of what I call the global minotaur is very simple. We can complicate it to our heart's content, but the reality is exceptionally simple. They are simply not interested in lending. The reason they grew to the extent that they did was that they used a combination of, on the one hand, options and derivatives, and on the other hand, leverage, so as to borrow on the liability side of their accounts and bet on the asset side. The greater the leverage they employed in this transaction, the larger the profits from such activities, from such risky activities, the result being an exponential growth in their assets, profits, and of course, bonuses. Now, as a result, most SIFIs, loans to customers, became a decreasing proportion of the bank's assets. Less than 30% in most cases. Now, from the SIFI's perspective, the SIFIs, remember, are the systematically important financial institutions. I avoid the term too big to fail, because usually it's not too big to fail, but too complex to fail. Now, from their perspective, from which all that matters is profit making, naturally, we, customers, small and medium enterprises, households, are not that exciting. During the good times, we may have benefited from the growth of the cities and their largesse in a global environment of credit-fueled growth rates, which were the reflection of the capital flight into the United States that I referred to earlier, which financed the United States deficits, which in turn created the requisite aggregate demand worldwide for the net exports of the net exporters like China, like Latin America, and like Germany, like Japan. Alas, in the meantime, the world of finance was decoupling from the world of the real stuff produced by real people in real small, medium, and larger industrial outfits. Now, when the pyramid of derivative paper, a form of private money that Friedrich von Hayek would never have imagined, burst into flames and turned into ashes in 2008, the whole edifice came tumbling down. At that point, with regulators too timid to challenge the bankers, who, it must be said, were their colleagues until very recently, SIFIs experienced a dream come true. As they could rely on exponential profit-making during the upturn, suddenly they could rely on exponential bailouts during the downturn. Why should they, all of a sudden, become excited by the prospect of bread-and-butter banking, of lending to enterprises again? One party was ending and another one was beginning. The only danger on the horizon for SIFIs was greater regulation. To see it off, they employed terror tactics against the hand that had just fed them, particularly in a town called Washington, D.C. Now, to see in vivid technicolor how little SIFIs care about lending to little people, it is interesting to look into a scheme that the British government affected over the last year and a half, which is known as funding for lending. Now, the idea behind that scheme was to lend money to the banks cheaply, provided the banks would then lend it on to enterprises and households. About £17 billion, almost $30 billion, was lent to banks in Britain that way. Now, interestingly, some of those banks actually are owned by the British state following 2008. And yet the British state did not try to utilize its owner's rights in order to influence policy. They used market-based methods for this. What was the effect of these methods? Well, in the fourth quarter of 2012, lending fell by £2.4 billion, despite that those funding for lending loans that were extended to them. The Royal Bank of Scotland in particular borrowed £750 billion in order to lend to small enterprises, and guess what happened to its total lending to enterprises? It shrunk by £4 billion. HBOS borrowed £3 billion and culled its loans by £6 billion. So much for the success of the scheme. But the failure of the scheme is simply, as I said, an indication of the reluctance of banks to do what banks are supposed to be doing. Now, recap. SIFIs are a problem. Systemically important financial institutions are important for a variety of reasons. But let me stick to two. First, like oligopolists, they restrict quantities to push up price. And what's price? Interest rate spreads. There's nothing new there. It's first year microeconomics. But secondly, there is something that distinguishes SIFIs from the rest of the oligopolies that we know. Because the bigger they are, the more they profit by borrowing, as I said, on the liability side and betting on the asset side. They are effectively forced to lobby hard in order to retain the right to do so through thick and thin. Now, don't get me wrong, this is not an ethical critique of bank CEOs, of the SIFIs personnel, of traders, of their risk analysts. I have no doubt that each one of them is doing their best while working within a complex organization that will spew them out if they do otherwise. It is not at all a matter of ethics. It is more important than that. If you want, the situation resembles more a form of an ancient Greek tragedy where every protagonist is trying to do his or her best, but all of them, without realizing it, are contributing piecemeal to the final crescendo of the drama at the very end. What we must come to grips with is that large global banks, the SIFIs, have grown beyond a certain level of complexity and are now no longer capitalist enterprises. They are feudal entities. Manchester University anthropologist Carol Williams put it beautifully, I think. They have become loose confederacies of profit-seeking, rent-seeking franchises. Williams tells us that one risk analyst talks about his bank as a nation engaged in perpetual civil war, while a trader said, "You have to understand, it's us traders against the bank." Now, regulatory devices and hurdles are to these people nothing more than irritants to be circumnavigated and whose teeth must be removed. If traders and analysts fail to do this, their bosses will be compelled to get rid of them, as they themselves will be written off if they don't do that. It is a grave error to imagine that SIFIs are well-defined companies, business entities, run by smart bankers who know what they do and do what they know. Smart they may be, but they do not have a clear view of what is happening within the realm of their own banks. And more significantly, they can control very small parts of the feudal confederacy that they are supposedly watching over. That confederacy, the SIFI, runs its own show, as if by a will of its own, an unending quest for economic rents that are increasingly decoupled from the mundane task of lending to business. From a macro perspective, SIFIs are trouble because they profit through volatile lending. Too much when restraint is crucial, too little when credit is necessary. They constitute shock-maximizing institutions, volatility machines. Now, from what I read in here, and I stand to be corrected as a non-expert on the Mexican banking scene, it seems to be that Mexico's banks are a source of good and of bad news simultaneously. The good news is that they appear to have a healthy capital base and a low portion of bad assets. That certainly is good news. The speedy implementation of Basel III is also a source of pride and reflection in this country, it seems to me. Perhaps a reflection also of the Mexican regulators' urgency to put behind them the trauma of 1994-1995, and to be seen to be doing that through regulatory steps. However, the bad news is that credit seems relatively scarce at a time when the economy starved of credit-fueled growth. And, from what I hear, possessions are on the rise. Now, there's more bad news, I'm afraid. Basel III compliance is a fig leaf. It may sound wonderful, but in reality, at least in my reality, it means very, very little. Lehman Brothers, Wachovia, Citigroup in the United States, Northern Rock in Britain, the Greek and Cypriot banks, Bankia in Spain, Dexia in the Benelux countries, would all have passed Basel III criteria with flying colors the day they failed. Now, what happened, of course, in those cases, was a systemic collapse of the sort that the Mexican oligopolistic, highly concentrated banking sector is susceptible to as we speak. What we should never forget is that when a crisis hits, especially when it hits a peripheral economy, whether it's Spain in Europe or Mexico within NAFTA, global banks just walk away. Even if they own subsidiaries in the hit nation, they do. The fact that the SIFIs in this country happen to coincide with the global SIFIs is cause for concern. The moment the financial shock happens, as it is bound to periodically, the greater the concentration ratio of the banking sector and the more global the local banking sector is, the greater the proportion of bank assets that stand to wither. As a result, the greater the tendency of capital and of global banks to flee the hapless peripheral nation like a vicious tide, leaving behind nothing but mud and a few windy posts, the greater the impact on the real economy. Now, if the exposure of global banks to the periphery threatens the global banks, make no mistake, the metropolis will intervene. But only in order to save the global banks at whatever cost for the local economy. This is your experience with Brady bonds, with Rubin's 50 billion bailout after the 94 crash. And it certainly was the experience with our euro so-called bailouts, a cynical attempt to shift banking losses from the books of Deutsche Bank and BNP Paribas onto the shoulders of the German, the French, and, ridiculously, the very weak shoulders of the Greek taxpayers. Whenever we study the robustness of some banking sector, it is imperative that we go beyond banking and think in macroeconomic terms. Mexico's 1994 problems were not just due to problems in the banking sector, they were the result of a major recession that happened. As were the problems of the Greek banks in 2010. No banking reform, however cleverly conceived and implemented, offers insurance from a serious macroeconomic slump. And there is the rub. If my analysis of the deeper causes behind the 2008 crash and what followed after that, my Minotaur tale, holds any water, we have much to worry about. The United States trade deficit has returned after a lull in the post-2008 period. America's capacity, however, to generate aggregate demand for net exporters, on which the Mexican economy relies to a large extent, has subsided by 30% since 2007 on trend basis. At exactly the same time, the rest of the world's capital flow into the United States no longer has the capacity to finance anywhere near 2007-2008 standards United States corporations. The result is a global economy which is struggling to remain stable, let alone to grow again. Looking back to the 1990s, it is worthwhile to recognize that deregulation in finance, especially when it comes on the coattails of other forms of deregulation and liberalization, engenders an oligopolistic credit boom. Large global players emerge that operate as a conduit of the huge capital inflows, leading with mathematical precision to some kind of future shock. At the same time, deregulation removes the shock absorbers so that when the shock comes, it is gigantic. This is not an argument against deregulation. It is a statement of fact about all too common features of deregulation. At the same time, neither the money markets nor the macroeconomy develop fresh, new defense mechanisms for responding to such an eventuality, to the new shocks. Now, it was a distinguished alumnus of this fine institution, Mr. Augustin Carstens, then at the Bank of Mexico, who told my University of Texas colleague, Sidney Weintraub, now retired. He told him, "We took a calculated gamble and lost." Guillermo Ortiz, along the same lines, added, "In 1994, we bet that the shocks would be temporary here in Mexico. Alas, those were not gambles, no bets. Just like in 2010, the IMF's and Europe's bailout strategies in the Eurozone were not mere gambles or wagers, they were shots in the dark. A little like gambling that a light will appear at the end of the tunnel when you're digging perpendicularly." Clearly, something must be done to reduce systemic risks, to stop betting the nations, of especially peripheries which are populated by people in desperate need of poverty-fighting growth strategies. Something must be done to reduce the systemic risks that put in jeopardy these poverty-fighting strategies. Economies whose sustainable growth is not important for trivial reasons, but for real human life-enhancing reasons. Will Basel III do the trick? It won't do the trick. I already mentioned failed banks that passed its tests. Basel III does constitute an improvement over Basel II, but this is not to say much. What they fixed with Basel III is the way that they measure and define the numerator of the capitalization ratio. But the devil now resides in the denominator and in the risk models which are used in order to manipulate it. Ring fencing between casino banking and bread and butter banking within the same bank, which is the idea that is being tried in the United Kingdom, the Vickers report, is that the solution? No. This is a joke, and my British friends are cottoning on to it. In effect, ring fencing will simply annoy the CFIS personnel, who will find within a few days ways of going around it. Would a return to the Glass-Steagall Act of complete separation of investment from retail banking do the trick? Not really. I may support it, but primarily for psychological reasons, but not for logical reasons. Think of Northern Rock in Britain. It contained no investment branch. It simply went under as a result of the general trend of financialization in which that bank was caught up. So what do we do? Give up? No, of course not. Here's my two-pronged suggestion with which I will close today. We need, as my friend and colleague Anna Tadmati keeps saying, very high equity minima for CFIs and policies that actively encourage, nurture, motivate and assist small, local, non-CFI banks and make use of new methods of mobilizing idle savings and channel them as productive investments towards small and medium enterprises. High equity minima, as suggested by Admati and her co-author Martin Helwig, for the large banks, so that they are forced to replace much of the risky derivative trade on their assets into boring loans to businesses and households. And at the same time, introduce policies that defeat the CFI monoculture, helping a rich ecology of homegrown credit institutions develop in the CFI's shadow, thus providing much needed competition to them. For instance, phase in Basel III provisions much more slowly for local Mexican firms. Because doing as you are proposing to do now, bringing in Basel III provisions with no differentiation between the institutions that will be treated to this therapy, effectively reduces the competition that the CFIs in this country are facing without making the CFIs safer. So what we need, in other words, is simple rules that will remove not so much the size of the banks, but the complexity of their regulatory devices and their reliance on mark-to-market, to model methods, and allow a thousand flowers to bloom in credit provision by Lilliputian institutions, which collectively can fill the funding gap and the competition gap that we are now experiencing. So, time to take stock. If my analysis is right, and I do hope that it is not, the global economy is and will remain in a fairly depressed state until some newfangled surplus recycling mechanism is discovered, comes into being. Until then, economic life will be stressful the world over and highly volatile. In this global context, an economy like Mexico's requires courageous financial reform that is not at the mercy of the CFIs, that have every incentive in the world to turn reform into bigger rents at the expense of the social economy. The good news is that many people the world over, producers of real stuff in particular, are getting tired of CFIs, their lobbyists, and the dearth of credit that that causes. There is indeed a global move towards smaller local banks with high equity and immobile capital bases that is turned directly into community SMEs. Mexico seems to be blessed with a flourishing sector of that ilk, an array of small credit providers, banks and non-banks, whose credit supply has been growing even during the worst quarters after 2008. Quite remarkable. Mexican authorities need to protect and nurture them. And the easiest way of doing this is not to treat them as if they are identical to the global SIFIs dominating the scene. Smaller banks and non-bank financial institutions differ from SIFIs in one important respect. They lack the capacity to bend the spirit of Basel III. In this sense, they are the regulator's friends. But they suffer from an incapacity to use the SIFIs instruments of circumnavigating Basel III, like COCOs, their capacity to issue instruments that allow them to comply with the new rules. The rush to Basel III is thus ill-advised, I think, in Mexico. At least the uniform rush. It does not make the SIFIs safer, and it impairs the smaller banks that are serving Mexico's social economy quite well. The solution, as Atmati suggests, go for a minimum equity ratio of between 10 and 15% for banks whose assets exceed a certain level, and allow smaller Mexican-owned banks more leeway. Naturally, this suggestion is going to meet with huge resistance, a cacophony of protestation. It will bring about accusations that equity-based arguments fail to grasp the complexity of banks. Now, Paul Volcker's rejoinder to the accusation of not having grasped the importance of the SIFIs financial innovations was, you will remember, that in all his years in the world of banking, the only financial innovation he ever came across was the ATM. My rejoinder to the argument that a bank is too complicated for me or for the average citizen to understand in terms of equity ratios, let alone for the man or woman on the street, is that if their risk-weighted models are too intricate for our common minds to grasp, then they are too intricate for a common politician to support using common taxpayers' hard-earned cash to subsidize them. Thank you very much.